I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. There's a shadow on this era by now, seen over and over all across the country in communities you'd never heard of before. It's the one-man apocalypse. Explosive anger with a gun in its hand.
So, if you are just joining us, two young men apparently dressed in long black trench coats opened fire about an hour and a half ago at a high school just outside of Denver in Littleton, Colorado.
Since Columbine, 16 years ago, public massacres at roughly 60-day intervals have become almost familiar, shocking every time, though they start to sound the same and patterns begin to emerge.
So we want to tell you first off what the suspect looks like. We've been told he's a 20-something-year-old white male.
An angry and psychologically twisted young man whose public rant.
A young white man, 5'9", slender, clean.
The alleged gunman appears to be in his late 20s.
The young man there in the red hoodie is a suspect. He's 17 years old.
There's a 32-year-old ethnic Norwegian man has been arrested in connection with that attack.
The scenes are all too familiar. It happened today in Oregon when a man started shooting in classrooms at a college. This evening.
This mystery to be solved here. This Open Source Radio Hour, we're comparing notes from psychiatry, anthropology, paleontology, on the not quite exclusively American phenomenon of the shooting spree. Our lead guest, Andrew Solomon, has written a classic text on children that take startling turns for better and worse. The book is Far From the Tree, about kids who shock their parents with prodigious skill on the violin, or criminality, or schizophrenia, or autistic silence. Each case a mystery, each on a path that couldn't have been foretold. I'm asking Andrew Solomon to share what he has learned close up about those headline shooters.
I think it's important that we consider in these instances that each of these people was both homicidal and suicidal. A. Alvarez, who was the great philosopher of suicide, once commented that suicide requires the wish to kill, the wish to die, and the wish to be killed, and that they all come together.
President Obama says we're growing numb to this mystery long before we can even describe what it is or its roots in our guns, our genes, our times, our culture, some evolutionary kink in the males of the species. Where do we start looking for roots?
You know, aggression is something for which there is an evolutionary imperative. We were bred to have aggressive males who fought off other males. That was how they got the right to inseminate females, you know, going back thousands and tens of thousands of years into evolutionary history. And aggression actually, in many instances, serves men very well even today. It allows them to get ahead in business. It allows them to achieve power and wealth and all of those other things that our society tends to place a high value on. So aggression is useful. But if you have a system within which you have a quality such as aggression that's useful, it is almost always the case that people are going to have a dysregulated relationship to it, and they're going to have extreme aggression. In the same way that somebody's ability to imagine a different world is terrific, and someone's inability to live in the real world constitutes schizophrenia, or somebody's ability to have a broad mood spectrum is invaluable, and someone's descent into paralyzing depression is a disaster. Those are the kinds of issues that we look at, and I think aggression is actually very useful, and if we didn't have any aggression, we'd be in bad shape, and it's mostly been a male trait, though I think the distinction is breaking down a bit. And if we have a society in which depression is valued, we're going to have people who get terribly carried away with it and take it to a level at which it is perilous and terrifying and extremely dangerous.
Andrew Solomon, in this book we can't put down, Far From the Tree, you've written that when these news stories pop, your first thought is often, that's somebody's kid. What do you mean by that?
I've spent time interviewing the parents of people who've committed crimes like this. The general understanding is that criminality is the result of poor parenting. We used to think that autism was the result of refrigerator mothers. We used to think that schizophrenia was caused by parents who had an unconscious wish that their child not exist, that people were gay because they had overbearing mothers and passive fathers. Going back a couple of hundred years, that people had deformities because their mothers had unexpressed lascivious longings. And we dropped the game of parental blame on almost all of those and many other conditions for which we used to blame parents. But we still blame parents when children explode into this kind of bizarre and aberrant behavior. And it's actually, in many instances, no more justified than those other forms of blame were. There is no question that children who suffer abuse and neglect may have criminal tendencies exacerbated. And if you're interviewing gang members, you'll find a lot of them come from troubled backgrounds. But the kids who escalate to this kind of really extreme and bizarre behavior are often, not always, but often, children of loving and appealing families. And having spent time especially with the family of Dylan Klebold and with the father of Adam Lanza, Dylan Klebold is Columbine and Adam Lanza is Newtown. I happen to be very fond of my own parents and wouldn't want to turn them in, but it would have been fine to grow up with those people. I mean, they're attentive, they're intelligent, they were deeply concerned to try to do the best they could with their children. Children are frighteningly unknowable and can be frighteningly uncontrollable.
Go back to that very provocative phrase, that's somebody's kid. Does that mean it could have been anybody's kid?
There are instances in which they knew their child was disturbed and was having a rough time but had no idea he was dangerous. And there are instances in which they thought their child was absolutely fine. And I came away from it thinking that my own children, who are the most delightful and beloved children and still very small, I thought it's not impossible that it could happen in my household. It's not impossible this could happen. And I think parents are terrified by that notion and that they therefore resist it mightily.
But is it a random spread of these killers?
It's random in the same way that any other sort of strangeness is random. I mean, anybody could end up with a child with cerebral palsy, or anybody could end up with a child who's gay, or anyone could end up with a child who's deaf, or any of these other things. Now, I don't know that we have a sufficient understanding at this point to be able to say there's a specific biology to this. We certainly, even if we posit that there is such a biology, don't know what it is. But I think that there is a sense in which these families are all addressing children who have something very broken in them. And children can be very capable at hiding the brokenness inside of them. And what I have found in talking to these families, the reason I think that's somebody's kid, I think that's somebody's kid because these families are so destroyed. In these instances, having lost not only their child, who has committed suicide in the course of this whole thing, but all of their certainties about the world, all of their belief in their own capacity to be moral people and teach someone else to be a moral person, and all of the convictions they had about a child who, in every one of the instances I've described, was deeply and profoundly loved.
So many differences, but so many common threads, too. I mean, there's social isolation among these kids. They've been bullied, a lot of them. They're out of the fashionable flow of school. They're angry all the time. What is it about the young man with the wrong shoes, the wrong friends, that is infinitely more painful than we ever imagined?
Well, you know, adolescents in particular, and these are in general people in adolescence or early adulthood, adolescence is the period in one's life when one most wants to fit in, or at least most people most want to fit in and to conform. There were rantings from the Oregon shooter that he left behind about not having a girlfriend. People don't understand that there's a great deal of time ahead and that you might eventually have a girlfriend. And they also don't want to take on board the idea that perhaps something in their personality is keeping girlfriends away and they should learn how to change in a way that would make them more attractive to other people, more socially attractive, more erotically attractive, more attractive at whatever level it is they need to be attractive. I think it's a very vulnerable age, and I think many adolescents follow in the Holden Caulfield mode, and they're disillusioned, and they're troubled, and they have a disregard for all of the authority that's constraining them, and they need to express that somehow. You know, Holden expressed it by running away and wandering through Central Park, and Dylan Klebold expressed it by going and blowing up the school and killing himself. One of those is obviously a better solution than the other, but I think they come from the same point of origin.
Mm-hmm. Are we getting comfortable with identifying the sort of category here? I'm thinking, if it was old black women, say, from the Great Lakes who are doing these shootings, we'd see the pattern immediately. Why is it so hard to say we've got a problem with white, young, middle-class men?
I think we may have a problem saying it, but I think most of us recognize it. There is a lot of disaffection taking place in our society. Now, I think there are a lot of macro causes for that. You know, we have much less social mobility than we had when I was growing up, and people feel stymied by that. We have an internet culture that allows a lot of brutality and bullying. We have an entertainment industry that glamorizes violence and substance abuse. We have higher rates of alienation because people interact with machines instead of with people all the time. There was that fantastic campaign that the Anti-Suicide Jed Foundation ran last year for students that said 3,000 Facebook friends and no one to talk to. I think that's true of a surprisingly large number of students, and I think they all think they're the only one. They think nobody else is going through that. We have a problem there. Sometimes that problem manifests in this kind of shooting, and that, of course, grabs a lot of headlines. We should be trying to deal with that problem of disaffection in people who are in many instances quite bright and have the potential to be productive members of the society, even if they aren't going in and shooting people up in school. I mean, the candidates who are in the Republican primaries have all now spoken out about the fact that the problem here isn't guns, it's mental health care. And it's striking that their interest in mental health care appears to be restricted to these incidents in which there have been acts of violence. Only 5% of violence is committed by people with mental health diagnoses, and only 5% of people with mental health diagnoses commit acts of violence. So it isn't as though now we know what it is and it's a syndrome and we can identify it and we can get all of those people put away and the whole thing's going to be fine. We have a problem. We have a problem of profound alienation. We have a problem of access to guns. We have a problem of a culture that endorses violence. We have those problems coming together, and we should address those problems not only because of school shootings, but also because of the vast sadness there is. Because if the high rates of suicide among people who, because it's not a murder-suicide, don't make it into the headlines, but who have nonetheless killed themselves for reasons that are in some ways similar to part of what appears to have driven these shooters.
There's more of the extraordinary Andrew Solomon on our website, radioopensource.org. Coming up, with the primatologist Richard Wrangham, who wrote the book on demonic males, what is to learn about school shooters from, say, killer gangs of chimpanzees? This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What part of the headline shooting spree is rooted in the genes of the shooters? Or maybe in the genome of humanity? What part is located in the prehistory of our species, in the evolution of primates at large? Our guest, Richard Wrangham, is an evolutionary biologist at Harvard. Almost 20 years ago, pre-Columbine, he wrote a famous book, Demonic Males, that is still argued about and still relevant. Welcome, Richard Wrangham.
Thanks.
In short, what's the deep, I mean way deep, millions of years deep, history of this behavior?
When I go studying chimpanzees, I see males who are fighting over nothing all the time. They're fighting over nothing because what they're fighting over is status. It's not food at the time. It's not females at the time. It's who is the dominant individual. Because once you get to be dominant, you stay dominant for months or maybe years or maybe decades at a time. So dominance matters hugely because what it does is it gives you access to the females, to the food, to the things that matter. Well, in many ways, what we're seeing with humans, what we're seeing with these tragic young males, is something that we see in an enormous number of animals, which is that there is a competition for status. And the competition plays out such that the winners are puffed up and continue to be aggressive and continue to live social lives. And the losers learn to accept defeat. They learn it in the sense that it takes them out of immediate fighting. They become antisocial. They, if you were a hamster, you might end up curled away in the corner of the cage. You eat less. Your testosterone falls. And you just get used to being a loser. But there's something very peculiar about humans. And they share it, actually, with chimpanzees, which is that there are two types of aggression that have been really important in their evolutionary past. And one is the type we've just been talking about, which is fighting one-on-one over something. And very often it's over, in a sense, nothing. It's status. But the other kind of aggression is cold, premeditated aggression, unlike the hot aggression that comes when you're fighting together with an opponent. The cold aggression is predatory. It's the one that says, I think I have an opportunity to achieve a goal, and I'll take out some individual. The way chimpanzees do it, they show this demonic behavior by going to the edges of their range and looking for members of neighboring groups, and they kill them. A very unusual thing to do in animals.
Alone or together?
It's always together. One of the most extraordinary observations is this, that you've got a chimpanzee, which is an animal 3 or 4 times as strong as a human. We've got dozens of records of them being killed by other chimps, and the other chimps have never received a serious wound. They're able to kill these because they choose to do it at a time when they have overwhelming power. But what this
almost nuclear overcapacity.
Yes, it's of course, you know, you say nuclear, but that's only when only one side has the nuclear weapons. So they're able to do this, and they're able to choose when to do it. They can choose only to exert this extraordinary power when they have a completely helpless victim. So this is a second type of aggression that very few animals have. Humans, chimpanzees, wolves, lions, but not your typical rodents or antelope. And I think what we're seeing with these young men is a pattern in which, first of all, they experience conditioned defeat. I mean, of course, there's lots of variation, but once
before it happens, leading to the depression, isolation.
They become the
loser.
It seems harsh, but yeah, the losers in their school settings. And maybe they have particularly high expectations or what, but they curl up and go away. And then it's as if they are able to summon a series of allies on their side. And in this case, in this crude and simple reading, the allies are a gun. Because what a gun does is to give you, temporarily in this case, the kind of power that a chimpanzee has when it has 15 allies on its side facing one.
It used to be sold as the equalizer. It was a sales term for guns made here in New England.
Which is probably the way that people are thinking about it now in the NRA.
Yeah.
But really, of course, very often what guns are is the unequalizer. Because if you are premeditating violence, then you are choosing to use a gun against somebody who does not have one.
Let's note one thing that's important. This is apocalyptic killing in the sense that this is end-it-all killing. It's not to dominate. Now I'll rule the valley or the roost or the family. It's over. Can there be any sort of conscious purpose in that kind of killing?
Well, clearly something is going wrong, and the combination of homicide and suicide is patently pathological. But my point is that the homicide part of it is something that fits very much into what we see in other animals, the conditioned defeat leading to an intense desire to overcome that, and in the case of these young men, an ability to fulfill that desire. Why it is then accompanied by suicide and why they don't anticipate the fact that the combination is absurd is, of course, the great tragedy.
We're going to come back to a line of yours that I find immensely interesting and provocative. You write in your book, the problem is that males, that's us, are demonic at unconscious and irrational levels. Let people think about that. I want to introduce Dr. Melvin Connor, who joins us from Atlanta. He's a medical anthropologist, and then he became a medical doctor too. His new book, titled Women After All, opens bluntly with a simple-sounding argument that women, I'm quoting, are not equal to men. They are superior in many ways and in most ways that will count in the future, not for their culture or their upbringing, but as a matter of biology. Welcome, Melvin Connor. What does a feminist man, as I take you to be, a man, scientist, and doctor, what do you see playing out in this 21st century guy epidemic of mass shooting?
Well, I have to basically agree with everything Richard said. I would point out on the downside that there are a lot of human societies where similar group raids on isolated individuals in a neighboring group are routine. And you know, one example that comes to mind is the Ilongot of the South Seas, where they were traditionally headhunters, and it used to be said that a man couldn't expect to get married until he had actually taken a head of a man from a neighboring, or someone from a neighboring group, not necessarily a man. And raiding among the people of Highland New Guinea and the famous fierce people in Venezuela, the Yanomamo, these are groups that are known for their belligerence, but actually most of the killings are in, I have to say, chimpanzee-style raids on isolated, by groups of men, on isolated individuals. And we're virtually always talking about men. Dr. Solomon said that for thousands of years, violence has been a route to access to women for men. And we have more and more evidence historically, anthropologically, even genetically, that that is true. As you and Richard were saying in the last part of your conversation, it's an irrational outburst when it ends in suicide for a young man, and it's virtually always a young man, and that seems like it's inexplicable in evolutionary terms, but it's not a tremendous misfiring of a basic process, which, if you don't end up dead, which most men who've committed acts of violence in history perhaps have not ended up dead, they may end up succeeding in the various ways that Richard talked about, and that's true of humans too.
Dr. Connor, but I also address this to Dr. Wrangham. In what sense or senses is maleness itself the problem? I'm quoting from a review of your book, Dr. Connor, but just simply pointing out that the single chunk of DNA that makes its carrier male also dooms its carrier to, among other things, shorter lifespans, a greater probability of death due to accidents, as well as an increased risk of being not only violent, but also a victim of violence. More than 90% of people who run afoul of the law and are currently incarcerated carry that little single chunk of DNA. I mean, is maleness a disease?
Well, it's kind of a joke, or at least a trope that I put forward there. In fact, I gave it a name, which is X chromosome deficiency syndrome. and my students get a kick out of that, and some of my readers have. But I have to say, not everyone got the joke. Obviously, men and women are different and have their respective strengths. But when I say that women are superior in most ways that will matter in the future, I'm talking about this dimension of violence, and also the dimension of what I call driven sexuality, which often ends in exploitative sexuality. The Umpqua shooter left ravings, so-called writings, in which he talked about not being able to get a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. That's a very precise echo of the Santa Barbara shooter, whose reams of internet drivel before he killed, I think, 7 or 8 people of both sexes a couple of years ago, he showed his obsession with the fact that he couldn't get a girlfriend, and couldn't understand why they didn't see what a great guy he was. You know, the connection between, that there's a toxic connection between violence and sexuality in males that is simply dangerous and is something you don't see, you practically never see in someone who has a full complement of two X chromosomes. The upside, and I am saying that with a smile on my face, and the upside of the whole evolutionary story that I'd like to hear Richard's observations on is that there's another species of ape that we're equally closely related to, that is genetically as close to us as chimpanzees, and they're called bonobos, and they're not like that.
We know them well. Not that
they don't have, not that they don't have conflict and status competition, but it just doesn't seem to get to the point that chimpanzee competition regularly gets to.
I want Richard Wrangham's reaction to your general argument that femaleness is a gift, bonobos and humans too, for trustworthiness, reliability, fairness, working and playing well with others, relative freedom from distracting sexual impulses. You know the litany. Richard Wrangham.
Well, I suspect that we would have a more peaceful world in general if there were more countries like Rwanda, where you actually had around 50% of the women in the legislature, as opposed to being dominated by men. But I am sensitive to some of the problems that women have, such as that they hold grudges longer. There's quite a lot of evidence about that, and that makes sense in evolutionary terms, because men, when they fight within their groups, need to be able to reconcile with each other and form bonds to fight against the neighbors, in which the women don't. These are specifics about humans. You know, one of the things that comes to mind when you say, are males inherently a problem, is that it's not maleness. It's not that little bit of the Y chromosome that shoots us off in a particular direction necessarily. It's maleness in our species. So there are species in which males are kind of just fine. But in general, they're not. In general, they put too much effort into competition with each other, and the result is a mayhem that visits the rest of the species. So here's an example. Males very often, in most species, when they compete with each other, they get into long fights, and the reason they get into long fights is because both of them believe they're going to win. This makes sense because if they didn't both believe they would win, then obviously the fight would be over, because it's much better to lose without a fight than to lose with a fight. It's much better to get away without being wounded. So what natural selection has done is to give males the tendency to think that they are going to win even when that's not realistic. Hmm. Well, the result is that fights are very much more protracted than they otherwise would be. And you can see this playing out nowadays in battles where you have leaders of opposing sides who start throwing away, according to the military psychologists, the evidence that their side is actually not particularly strong compared to the opposition. They get into this psychological mindset that they just believe that they know everything, that they are the ones who should be taking their side into a fight, and millions can die as a result.
I'd like you to go back to the shooter problem. Andrew Solomon says it's not a mental illness. You say also, and it's obvious, it's a pathological outburst. Do we have a name for what those shooters are suffering? It sounds like kind of frustrated wannabe alpha maleness or something.
Yeah, it's that combined with the experience of persistent defeat. So they've been defeated repeatedly in their competition within their school, among their age mates. That's my reading of from what I know of many of the school shootings.
I keep wondering what, you know, a self-respecting chimp would say about it. He'd probably say, "Would you give me your gun for the weekend?" But what? From the chimp standpoint, what's going on here? except that, they, as you say, they've got a gun that suffices as a gang.
Yeah, I mean, what you see with chimps is that when an individual is defeated in competition for status, then typically they do what I described earlier, become antisocial, go away, and don't try hard. But just occasionally, they are able to rally a group, and the result is that a dominant individual can be killed. Sometimes they get a gun.
Dr. Connor, do you have, in brief, a name for what these killers, shooters, are suffering?
Well, it's, you know, it's easy to diagnose somebody at a distance in retrospect, especially after they're dead.
Right.
And I'm not a psychiatrist. Dr. Solomon said he doesn't think most of them have a diagnosable condition. But I think that you know, the things they do are prima facie evidence of at least conduct disorder. And when you look at their histories, these are isolated individuals. They are narcissistic.
There's a brokenness, you know,
they're not normal until the day before they do this, in my opinion.
Stand by, Dr. Connor. Coming up deeper into this matter of masculinity, real men, good men, main men, with the maestro of male studies on campus and popular psychology, Michael Kimmel. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We've been searching in psychology, primatology, genetics, culture, for roots of this modern American shooting spree. The sociologist Michael Kimmel says our common working definition of masculinity is a big part of the problem. The shooters we've been talking on the Columbine, Oregon model aren't repudiating our standards, Michael Kimmel says. They're way, way over conforming to it, extending it into insanity.
If I were to say to you, come on, Chris, man up, be a real man. What does that mean to you? You would say, be in charge, be in control, never show your feelings, never cry, be competitive, get rich, get laid.
How about be yourself, be responsible, you know, be decent?
No, I just said be a real man.
Uh-huh.
Forget the decent part. Now, if I ask you what it means to be a good man, then you'd say being responsible, respectful, honor, be generous and kind to others. But when I say, man the F up, be a real man, those ideas do not come into your head. You know, and if I'm failing at that, at proving my masculinity, my recourse, my legitimate recourse is violence. Here's the parallel for women. The feminist analysis of anorexia and bulimia, for example, eating disorders among teenage girls, has always been seen as they're deviant, there's a mental illness issue. And of course, that's also true. The norms of femininity, you can never be too thin, you always have to watch your weight. These are the ones who are overconformist to insane notions of what femininity actually means. Just as men who are violent, explosively violent, are overconformist to crazy notions of what masculinity means.
But where do these guys get images in reality? From, you know, internet porn, the Iliad and the Odyssey, from Shakespeare, from church?
They get them from everywhere. They get these images about what it means to be a good man from the Homeric, the Shakespearean, the Judeo-Christian. The Bible is basically a very, very long rule manual about how to be a good man. But when you ask me the question about online porn, which 100% of 14-year-olds have watched, in the absence of comprehensive sex education, online porn is the only sex education these guys have.
Mm.
They think that's what sex is supposed to look like. Now, Chris, this isn't on them. This is on us.
Mm. What else should we be doing, Michael?
Okay, let's listen to what guys say they want. Let's listen to what entry-level workers say they want. They want the same thing that entry-level women workers want. They want to be awesome parents. They want to have great careers. They want to balance work and family. What do we as a culture help do to enable them to do that? Absolutely nothing. There are four countries in the world, four, that offer no paid parental leave to anyone. You know what the other three are? Lesotho, Swaziland, and Papua New Guinea, and us. We offer no paid parental leave to anyone. This is an international scandal. And yet we seem to have no political will to address it. Comprehensive child care. These aren't women's issues. They're parents' issues.
There's another category we've got to deal with here, Michael, and it's ISIS, this nightmare of men, same age group, flocking toward Syria and Iraq to make a statement, maybe more masculine than political or religious. Account for that number, 30,000 young people heading into an orgy of killing.
Some of the understanding of ISIS, of course, that we've been getting from historians and from journalists is that these are young guys who are so disaffected and so alienated in their current circumstances, in the French suburbs, in the U.S., where they feel like they have no prospect, no future. There's no possibility for them. There's always that possibility of being drawn into a kind of religious messianic cult as a way to give your life meaning and purpose. Remember, these guys are not just going because they love guns and violence and love to kill. What they're also doing is they're looking for a place where they feel like they're going to be validated as men, where they're going to feel like they have a brotherhood, a community, some meaning, some purpose to life. You know, in some of these vast stretches of excerpts, like the ones that you saw, for example, in the movie Fight Club, guys are desperate for something that means something, something that matters to them. You know, after that movie came out, do you know how many actual fight clubs there were all over the country? In those fight clubs, guys were talking about they needed something that felt real. What really matters is not punching somebody else. It's being punched. It's being hit, feeling something, even if it's pain. I think these guys who are joining these movements are not joining because they have a committed ideological idea, a terrible misreading of the Quran or whatever. I think they are joining because they feel so desperate, so lonely, so miserable, and so incapable of finding a way to prove their masculinity, which is a goal for them. To feel like they're the head of the household, to feel like they have a great job, that they can support a family. This culture is not providing any of those things, and therefore, they're an enemy of the culture.
That was Michael Kimmel. He teaches at SUNY Stony Brook. His latest book is Angry Young Men. Back to Dr. Mel Konner in Atlanta, Richard Wrangham in our studio. Mel Konner, especially, do you want to advocate...
Michael just said is that he's normalizing these behaviors, and what kind of sick species are we that we kind of apologize and justify for this idea of masculinity that is violent and oppressive to women and oppressive to men who lose the competition and based on a complete fantasy world of male success and male validation.
Why haven't we retired the brand by now?
Well, I'm trying to do that. I mean, that's what Women After All is about. It's not retiring maleness, although that might be technically possible in the not too distant future. And you know, there has already been a book called The End of Men, which I'm not proposing, but. There is a brand that should be retired, which is the wrong brand of masculinity. You know, I lecture at the big courses. I talk about date rape. I say, you know, the women in the room can shut their ears. I want your men in the room to listen carefully. When a woman is drunk or half asleep, a real man doesn't screw her, and that's not the word I use. I won't say it on the radio. A real man takes her home, puts her to bed, and waits for another day. I mean, where's the achievement in this? Even if you're just putting notches on your belt, you want to be chosen by this young woman. you don't want to be having sex with a corpse, and that's the ideal of masculinity. Take her home, put her to bed, and wait for another day. And when the time comes, treat her properly and get your masculinity from doing that. Get your masculinity from protecting her. Get your masculinity from getting together with her and having children that you also protect and work to bring up in the right way, including the boys.
How do we get there, Richard Wrangham? You've spoken of, you know, fewer guns, more women.
Well, I mean, I certainly agree with Mel that, of course, about the ideal of a real man. The problem is how you get there because of our evolutionary psychology. The fact is that in the past we can confidently reconstruct, as Mel was saying earlier, that the unpleasant, violent, immoral men, as it were, would be the ones that get the women and get the reproductive success and pass on their genes. And to say now that we must encourage men to behave in the admirable ways that Mel and Michael Kimmel were describing is, I'm convinced, not enough. We will continue to have men who behave entirely in opposite ways and take advantage of any kind of freedoms they get. I think the reason that
this is where the daimonic and the irrational come in, which you say was the problem, is the problem.
That's right. That's right. And the reason that we are living in a much more peaceful world now than we did 100 years ago or 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago is because we have better controls on people. We have better systems for seeing where violence is threatening and making sure it doesn't happen.
I'd like you both to sort of sum it up so far. What we're talking about in the shooter syndrome is millions of years deep. It's not exactly a disease. It's a very, very good fit with aspects of our culture, which is overarmed, over-sexualized, media-saturated. But it's not ideological. It's not religious. It's not purposeful. It's not Marxist. It's not Tea Party. And Andrew Solomon says it could be random. Richard.
Well, I doubt if any of this is truly random. I mean, you can follow the history of
those individuals. But he says it could happen in his household.
Yeah, random in that sense, yes. And it seems to me that there are two big problems. One is, the way we touched on them, that these young men are not part of a bonding group. Mostly when men suffer the slings and arrows of defeat in competition for status, they have the consolation of being part of a group that brings them along, that reconciles them to their fate, that cheers them up, that involves them in activities. And the way that the school social systems and the towns of these people are organized, it is possible for the young men to just to go away and hide. So then they don't have that positive possibility of being reincorporated into society. And then the other problem, of course, is access to guns.
What about the bonobo model? If you talk about controlling people, and especially controlling males, don't we have a model there that's something of a beacon of light in all this?
So you're thinking about the fact that in bonobos, the males are very largely controlled by females. The male that gets out of hand, then he suffers the fact of a bunch of females charging at him and stopping him from being violent.
Yes, exactly. And so we now have the triangulation of the chimp and bonobo and human genomes, and people are studying the heck out of it. And we don't know much about the behavioral genetics. But I've heard you say, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that these species are really fundamentally different, which I take to mean that there's probably something, at least partly genetic, about the difference in the way their social organization ends up being so violent in one of them and much less violent in the other. And as you say, partly due to the success of females in forming coalitions. And when I look at bonobos, I see pretty happy males. They're getting lots of sex. They're
all played by Alan Alda, right?
No, but I mean, of course, it's right that if males behave in less violent ways, then everybody benefits, except the males that are giving up something, and they're only going to give it up if they are forced to. Unfortunately, bonobos are, as you say, genetically different, and we can't wait for evolution to take place and for our genes to change.
We can't vote on handing it over to the bonobos either. I want to ask you both, what part of all this did my hero, William James, not understand precisely? He died 100 years ago. He said history is a bath of blood. Man is once for all a fighting animal. The toughest male, that's tooth and claw, is the one who gets the female and fathers the next generation. That's us and our kids. Centuries of peace, he said, could not breed that out of us. His answer was the moral equivalent of war. Organize men, strong men at the top, around baseball leagues, civilian conservation corps, all sorts of good efforts, but use those fighting instincts for something other than fighting. Isn't that still what we're talking about?
I think in many ways it is. I do think that he can be brought up to date by separating two kinds of violence. There is the cold, premeditated violence, and there is the hot, aroused fighting that leads to the classic murder following an alcoholic fight in a bar. We're not a species that has a very high rate of the reactive, impulsive, hot aggression. Compared to chimps, it's something like a thousandth of the rate. We're actually downregulated very much in that way.
Really?
And the way that we are truly demonic is in our premeditated form, in which, as hunters and gatherers, as Mel was saying, there is a very high rate of violence that men visit on each other. The good thing here is that the premeditated form of aggression is something that is not subject to explosive disorder so much. It's cold and it's calculated and it's sensible, because in general, what individuals will do is withhold being aggressive if they see that it's not going to pay. They will only do what chimps do, fight when it really means that they can win. And it's only occasionally that you get these poor people who end up carrying out the premeditated aggression and then committing suicide. Mostly, we have a world in which we are already reasonably well-tamed, and we just want to take hold of that and keep on ensuring that people don't have the opportunity to get too easy access to weapons. And
I agree with that completely, and that's one of the control elements, and it's one of the ways in which American society is completely off the scale of other advanced, well-educated, healthy countries. The Republican presidential debates and competitions are, I have to say, pretty entertaining, but also very tragic, in the sense that that these people are all hiding behind a distorted interpretation of the Second Amendment of the Constitution, and not willing to recognize that this is not what the founding fathers and mothers meant by freedom to bear arms and have a well organized militia. Exact wording is close to that, there will still be, without such easy availability of guns, some guys will get guns and do this stuff. I get that. It happened in Norway, which has a lot more gun control than we have.
The dangerous thing, I'll put this to Richard Wrangham, the dangerous thing, looking at politics in general, is not the arms. We're maybe better off than the chimps in our armaments, but it's the suicidal aberration in leadership here or someplace else. Do I take you right?
But I think it's very important what Richard said, that we are getting better in this regard. It's hard to see that sometimes when you watch the news and see ISIS and see these mass shooters like the Umkar guy. But it used to be much worse.
Richard Wrangham?
The enormous power that individuals can have is what makes us dangerous. And what we really need to do is to remember always that we are a fundamentally social species, and particularly the males, curiously enough, in many ways are more social than females. And if we see young men who are being isolated, that's when they become dangerous, if they have access to weapons. Bring them into the society. Give them sports, as William James said. Incorporate them into our world. And then that will take care of a lot of the problem, I'm sure.
I think of William James and that remedy. I always think of Legion, American Legion baseball. Ex-warriors overseeing young men playing, the national pastime.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't literally have to be the sport, but just anything which brings them into feeling part of the group.
So fascinating. Thank you, Richard Wrangham, Melvin Connor, Andrew Solomon, and Michael Kimmel, too. There's a much longer interview with Andrew Solomon on our website, and a bonus that we've unearthed, a conversation with the late, great Yogi Berra, all on our website, radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced by our primate producers Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Pat Tomino, and Zach Goldhammer. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our kinder, gentler, missing link. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.